In the Mayflower Congregational Church Bulletin from Oklahoma City, which I read a couple of days ago, the heading went like this: The Father and Son Pulpit Shuffle. I smiled until I read the next line. On Sunday, September 21st, the elder Dr. Myers will be preaching in the Mayflower pulpit. I find this reference to age gratuitous and unacceptable, but it is too late to do anything about it, except to remind you that there will be in your pulpit next Sunday a certain young pup whose dampness behind the ears you must try not to notice. In spite of these things, I know you will make our son Robin and his family welcome at UCC next Sunday when he and I swap pulpits. You are always excellent listeners. I need to ask you this morning to listen with extra care because of the nature of what I'm saying. A reporter had a backstage interview once with Anna Pavlova, the great Russian ballerina. He asked her to talk about the meaning of her dance. She looked at him with a genuinely puzzled expression. If I could say it, do you think I would have danced it? It was impossible, in other words, for her to give her performance a purely literal meaning. To do that would be to reduce it to something else. All the subtle nuances and delicate shadings of the dance itself would be lost. Well, I wish to claim this morning that we have a parallel in religion. Somebody commented once that religion is not so much thought out as danced out. He meant that it is not an intellectual exercise so much as it is a joyous affirmation, not so much a thing of factual language in its deepest mystery as it is of myth and symbol and metaphor. If we insist on giving such moments a literal, one-dimensional meaning, we shrink them and we distort their meaning. I realize that the moment some people hear the word myth, they think instantly that we are somehow devaluing and undercutting the importance of a story. Myth to them means the same as falsehood. This is mistaken and unfortunate because primitive man spoke his most vital truths by way of myth. He told stories to explain what he sensed to be the truth, a truth too wondrous for him to know how to explain in any other way. Or, as someone else put it, myth is my tongue, which means not that I cheat, but that I stagger in a light too great to bear. I tell stories to express the inexpressible. So if an Old Testament scholar calls the Tower of Babel story a myth, he does not mean that it has no truth. He only means that there may be an inexpressible mystery deep in the heart of that story, and that we are driven to myth in our weak efforts to communicate that mystery. The sad fact is that the literal imagination is severely limited. Words mean one thing and one thing only. They do not bristle with meanings and possibilities. They are bland and clean-shaven. And oddly enough, although reading literally is considered to be the old-fashioned way of approaching the Bible, the truth is that biblical writers were not literalists. They used myth and metaphor and symbol in luxurious profusion, and they did so with obvious delight. It is a modern notion to think that the words of the creation story, for example, can be read only one way, that is, scientifically, historically, literally. People who say that the first chapter in Genesis should be read in the classroom as an alternative to the theory of evolution make a strange kind of mistake. They assume that Genesis is trying to give us something comparable to science and history. Even the more liberal Christians, who do not take the creation story literally, have a tendency to surrender to the spirit of the times. That is, they sigh with great relief when someone tells them that the sequence of days in Genesis 1, if they are taken as eons rather than 24-hour days, offer a rough approximation to modern theories of how life evolved. They are so eager to make the Bible scientific, brackets, that is, respectable, that they leap at any chance to find something in Genesis that seems to harmonize with science. But when you look more closely at the first chapter of Genesis, it won't work. Vegetation comes into existence on the third day, while the sun isn't created until the fourth. Light is created on the first day, before the sun is created, and there is no hint at all that the writer cared in that story about purely scientific truth. The way to handle that material in Genesis is to do honor to the dance, to understand and rejoice in the symbol-using mind that composed those ancient documents. We insist on taking the 6 days as 6 real days, 24 hours in each, or else we take them as long geologic periods in an effort to make the story conform to science. But both approaches do an injustice to the ancient storyteller. The use of numbers in ancient religion was usually symbolic rather than mathematical. Creation is framed within a 7-day period because 7 was the perfect number, the number of completeness. We had to convert this approach, which is called numerology, into arithmetic in order to have modern math and science. Numbers had to be neutralized and emptied of symbolic meaning so they could be used in straightforward and literal ways. The one surviving exception may be 13, which still keeps a strange power over Fridays and over the listing of floors in hotels and high-rise apartments. But if you want an idea of the way numbers had meaning in the Old Testament, our feeling about the number 13 can help. So instead of thinking of arithmetic when we read the first creation story in Genesis, We should remember instead that those 6 days correlated with and supported a religious calendar already in existence when the creation story was written, and that it also supports the observance of the Sabbath, which was already in use among the Jewish people. If they had had a 5-day work week, the whole account would have been written differently. And in support of this non-literal way of reading, I ask you right now to consider how odd it is that God should have been said to take a rest. He really hadn't done anything in the story except speak a sentence or two each day. That isn't very tiring, even for us. And besides, any definition of God you are likely to read will include the notion that he is omnipotent and quite beyond getting tired or needing any rest, no matter how busy he is. So when we read that he rested on the 7th day, common sense ought to tell us to look for a clue to meaning other than what the words seem literally to be saying. Since there's so much in the news right now about creationism and evolution, let's talk a little more about what the creation story was meant to accomplish. Keep in mind that science did not exist when the story was written. What did exist, and what pressed in on the Jewish faith from all sides, was the religious problem of idolatry. Is there one God who is all-powerful and has created everything? Or are there many gods? Gods of earth and sun and sea and stars. That was the burning issue of the day, not creationism or evolution. Let me try again to be clear about what I mean. Keep in mind that the countries all around Israel were polytheistic. The sun and moon and stars were gods. There was a god of light and a god of darkness, a god of rivers, a god of animals, a god of fertility. On top of that worship of nature, there were pharaohs and kings and heroes who were also seen as gods. And because this was everywhere, the Jewish people were constantly tempted to join the party. Imagine some ordinary Jewish man looking at the awesome might and splendor of Assyria or Babylon or Egypt and asking himself these questions. If our God is all powerful and we are his people, why does he let other nations under different gods walk all over us and take us captive? Maybe their gods are greater than ours. Maybe we are foolish to worship only one God when there seems to be so much more power in many of them. Idolatry was easy, which is why priests had to work so hard all the time to keep their people believing in a single, all-powerful deity who made everything. So you're one of those priests, and you sit down to write the story of creation, needing to remind your people of the special quality of their faith, of their relationship with a single, all-powerful God. Read Genesis 1 with that in mind, and you see that it is a theological statement, not a scientific one. A way of affirming monotheism as over against idolatry. Each single day of those 6 days of creation takes on some of the major idol gods of the time and declares that they are not gods at all, but simply things or creatures that the one true God had made. For example, on the first day, the God of light and the gods of darkness are dismissed. It was the one God of the Hebrew faith who said, "Let there be light." And there was light. So light is not a god. Light is something God made. And light is obedient to this one true God. The fact that the sun doesn't get created until a few days later has no importance at all for the writer. Whether he knew that we get light from the sun or whether he didn't know that is not important. He wasn't trying to write science. He was combating a religious error. And to do that, he made God himself the author of light and the author of darkness, which is light's great opposite. On the second day, God creates the sky and the sea. But these were gods also in the nations around Israel. So these gods too are dismissed. They are no more than the work of the one God's hand. And on top of that, they are made simply by his speaking a word. If you read ancient history and ancient mythology, you know that other gods talked about in other cultures worked, and they worked very hard in order to create. Yahweh, the God of the Hebrew people, had only to speak a word. He is superior to those other gods who mated or fought in the labor of creation. Is a bull a god, as the Egyptians thought? Or a bird? No, because on the fifth and sixth days, the true God made those creatures too. And so it is foolish, the writer lets us know, to think of them as divinities. And then, just in case anyone still might wish to worship a human being, whether a king or a pharaoh or a great hero, on the sixth day, this one God also made human beings. They are his creation. They are not gods. Do you hear now the message of Genesis? On each day of creation, another set of idols is smashed. These, O Israel, are not gods at all. They are the creations of that transcendent one who is not to be confused with anything else. The creation is good. It is very good, but it is not divine. We are to worship the one true God. And then at the end of the story, we may get a further clue about the purpose of that creation tale. The last verse says, "These are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created." Generations. It's an odd word to use if what we're being offered is a chronology of the days of creation. But to the people of that time, it might have called something special to mind. The pagan gods were all related to one another in different cultures as members of a family tree. We get a genealogy of them, as in Hesiod's Theogony, a kind of family tree of divinity in which the great tangle of Greek gods and goddesses is sorted out by generations. Uranus begat Cronos, Cronos begat Zeus, Zeus begat Prometheus. These are the generations of the gods. The Assyrians, Egyptians, Babylonians all had their generations of the gods. So the story of Genesis, the creation story, concludes after God has made everything, this one God without a wife, without a birth, without a battle, it concludes like this. These are the generation of the heaven and the earth when they were created. Want a genealogy of the gods? Well, there isn't any. One God, our God, did the whole thing. It may be an absolutely marvelous pun on the concept of the divine family tree. Now, if we read Genesis that way, the issue of who created the universe is settled for us. But the issue of how it was done is really not even under consideration. The story is neither creationist nor evolutionist. It is a marvelous piece of polemic writing designed to affirm faith in the one transcendent God. Trying to be loyal to the Bible by turning this story into science is like trying to be loyal to Jesus by arguing that the parables are actual events and that they only have meaning if they are taken literally. There is another creation story over in Isaiah 40, written at about the same time when it's thought Genesis 1 was written, when Jerusalem had been destroyed by an idolatrous country and many Jews were tempted to give up on their God who had let this happen. Isaiah, to counter that, listen carefully, describes a creation in which God measured the waters, all of the oceans and rivers and lakes of the earth, Isaiah says, in the hollow of his hand. Literal. Held all the soil of this earth in a bushel. Weighed the mountains on a balance and the hills on a pair of scales. It doesn't sound like anything God did in the Genesis story. But it doesn't matter. Isaiah is not trying for scientific accuracy, for literal fact. He is holding up in poetry the greatness of God who can hold the ocean in the palm of his hand and weigh Mount Everest on a bathroom scale. So how can you make an image, he is saying to his people, how can you make an image of a God like this? How can you make an image of so transcendent a God out of gold or silver or wood? It can't be done. He's the one, Isaiah says, listen to this, who led out the stars one by one and gave them names. So stop complaining, O Israel. Because this one everlasting God, says Isaiah, the creator of the world, grows neither weary nor faints, and he will take care of you. Now, if he never grows weary, why did he rest in the Genesis story? Oh, it doesn't matter. You can't use literalism to reduce these stories to the level of newspaper items. If there had been a controversy going on in the Babylonian public schools of the day, and had there been such schools, the issue in debate would not have been creationism or evolution, but monotheism versus idolatry. Are there many gods or only one? And the story of creation, whether you read it in Genesis or in Isaiah or in the Psalms is the Jewish answer to that debate. Someday soon, God willing, in our new building, some of us will sit down together and read Genesis in a classroom context and study it in slow and loving detail. Until then, may the good Lord keep our hearts warm and our heads clear. Amen.